We want to take a Friday break from the news to look at the science of the Olympics, with the London Games starting in just 2 weeks. And we start with a heartbreaking defeat from the last Summer Olympics in Beijing. American Lolo Jones had been called the fastest woman on earth and was a favorite to win the 100-meter hurdles. Those dreams were dashed in the finals.
And Jones is off to a very quick start, and so is Sally McClellan of Australia in lane three. But Jones is gaining ground quickly. She's out in front now. With only a few hurdles remaining, she's hit a hurdle and fallen back in the field, and Dawn Harper has taken the win. Lolo Jones has had a disaster in the final few hurdles, and that's the end of her race.
Jones, now 29 years old, is hoping to make a comeback at the 2012 Olympics, with the help from a team of 22 scientists and technicians who analyze her every move. Mark McCluskey wrote about this in Wired magazine and joins us from NPR in New York. Welcome.
Good to be here.
You watched Lolo Jones train for this Olympics. Give us an idea of some of the high-tech gear used to track and train her.
The big focus of the project that Jones was working on was really sort of technique and biomechanics. The hurdles, which is the event she runs, is an incredibly technical event. There are crucial form things that need to happen for an athlete to perform at his or her best. And so what Jones and her coach were looking for was as much information as they could possibly get on exactly what she was doing literally every millisecond of that race to see if there were flaws that they could look at improving.
Tell me something they saw, and what kind of advice did they give her to help improve?
They saw a few things, one of which is that her center of mass tended to wobble from left to right as she went down the track, which doesn't sound like a big deal, except it adds a millimeter here, a millimeter there, a couple centimeters here, and suddenly, you know, maybe you're running an extra foot. And when you're talking about a race that's decided literally by hundredths of a second, little flaws like that, running a little bit further than you have to, is a huge deal. So they did some work to try and correct that, some things to strengthen the left side of her body, which was seeming to be a little bit weaker as she landed.
And what kind of gear are they using to be able to see this? What kind of high-tech gadgets are attached to her, or is it also around her?
It's both. So one of the main things they were doing was using a motion capture system, the sort of thing that Hollywood uses to do CGI graphics that video game manufacturers have used. So she had reflective sensors placed all over her bodies and would run hurdles outdoors, and using motion capture cameras outside is really hard to do. Some of the technicians told me that they were the only ones crazy enough to try it. So that was a main thing, because once you have that data, you can plot every point on her body that has a sensor on it in space throughout the race. They also used a lot of high-speed cameras, a camera system called a phantom camera that takes thousands of frames a second and allows you to really visually hone in on things that even regular slow-motion cameras would never let you see.
You keep talking about this team of 22 scientists and technicians. Give us an idea, though, of the different types of scientists. Who are these people exactly who are working on this level of detail?
You have a lot of people with traditional sports backgrounds, so people who have come up through sort of the track coaching ranks, and including Lolo's coach, Coach Shaver, down at Louisiana State. Then you have the team that was put together by one of her sponsors, Red Bull, that included PhD sports scientists, people with very specific backgrounds in applied biomechanics who can take that information that they're gathering and start to look for ways to optimize her movement patterns. You had strength and conditioning folks to try and work on some of those things with her as well. And then just the production side of, like, the technicians to run all of this gear. It was quite an operation.
It sounds like a production. What was it like for Lolo to be getting all this data? Must have been a little overwhelming.
Well, and actually that's a really interesting facet of all of this, is scientists can actually generate far too much information for an athlete to ever process. You know, you're talking about somebody who's been doing this at an incredibly high level for a decade. To go to her 6 months before the Olympics and go, you know, you really should change this, might not actually be a great idea. So there's a pretty delicate dance, and a lot of times the coach acts as sort of a gatekeeper. You know, the coach can get a lot more information and then sort of work on what's actually attainable within the time span before an event like the Olympics.
We've been talking about running, but what about other sports? How is this type of technology being used?
It might not be the same technology in terms of motion capture, but this sort of very scientifically driven, very data-driven approach, every single sport, from basketball teams doing scouting reports on, you know, the USA basketball teams doing scouting reports for their international competition that they've never seen before, and they'll have reams and reams of data and charts, and like, here's how this player wants to shoot and what he likes to do. Gymnastics, which you would not think of as a particularly data-driven sport. A gymnastics routine has a particular start value. So the difficulty of the routine, each element in it is sort of given a numerical value, and that's sort of the best score you could ever get if you did it all perfectly. And so there's actually, oddly, a lot of sort of strategy and almost economic game theory around how hard a routine do I do? Like, how do I balance the risk-reward of a difficult routine against the potential risk of me not being able to pull it off well? And so coaches and gymnasts spend months thinking about the construction of those routines and sort of how it fits in with the overall competition. You could name a sport, and we could talk about sort of the scientific approaches. And then there are sort of the things that transcend all the sports, like nutrition and supplementation and making sure that strength and conditioning and that the athlete's ready to perform on the day of the event.
Well, that makes me think about viewers like me who are going to watch the Olympics and wonder whether I can see any of that. What does it mean for us as viewers of this?
It's hard to make visible the effort that goes into all of, it's hard to make visible at the start line of the 100-meter dash, an event that takes, 9.5 seconds now, the lifetime of training that has gotten an athlete there. And I don't know that this is something that sort of a viewer is ever going to see, but I think it's crucial to understand, just in the same way that I think to honor the crazy amount of effort and ability that it takes to get to the Olympics, I think it's interesting to remind ourselves that it's not just athletic effort now, it's also a highly scientific and intellectualized effort.
Well, let's talk about the countries that are employing this scientific approach the most. Australia, with just 22 million people, has been winning the most medals per capita in the last three Olympics. They really are the gold standard for this type of training. Tell me how it got started there.
Australia has an incredibly proud sporting tradition. In 1976, they had a terrible Olympics, and actually it was fairly scandalous. New Zealand won more medals than Australia did in the 76 Olympics in Montreal. This was a national scandal in Australia. There were commissions formed to look into this disaster. What the government decided to do is they decided to fund a sort of high-performance athletics program, modeled a little bit on what was happening at that point in the Eastern Bloc, in the Soviet countries, where you had these large state-run systems trying to identify and train athletes. You know, Australia didn't have the sort of, like, rip-you-out-of-your-home aspect that,
right.
that existed that, sometimes
that was
in
East
Germany.
Eastern Bloc, yes.
Yeah. In the intervening years, the Australian Institute of Sport, as it was called, has really become sort of the acknowledged world leader in gathering elite athletes and coaches and scientists and finding ways to work together to increase their performance.
We're going to hear more about how Australia has refined this scientific approach when we come back, and is the U.S. falling behind? More with Mark McCluskey of Wired Magazine in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation on building the perfect Olympic athlete with the help of high-tech gadgets and scientific analysis. Our guest is Mark McCluskey of Wired Magazine. And Mark, Wired put together a video of American hurdler Lolo Jones showing how motion capture sensors and high-definition video can track her performance. Let's listen.
Lolo runs the 100-meter course in about 12.5 seconds. It's 13.5 meters to the first hurdle, where Lolo reaches a speed of 8 meters per second. Her toe leaves the ground 2.3 meters from the first hurdle, but despite clearing the 83.8 centimeter hurdle, her center of mass rises less than 30 centimeters due to her efficient technique.
This is a really interesting video to watch, and we've linked to it on hereandnow.org. And it's cool to see how scientists can track the footfalls and give Lolo Jones instant feedback on how to improve. But Mark, before the break, you were saying that Australia is really at the forefront of using science to improve athletic performance, and that for the 2000 Sydney Games, the country put $20 million into its sports science research. Did that pay off for them?
It paid off handsomely. They had an unbelievably successful games.
Australian athletes won 58 medals.
58 medals in
Third
Sydney.
In the total podium count. That's tied with China.
And that's a population about the size of New York State. I think that for Australia, it has been a real point of national pride. And you've seen since then other countries, when they win an Olympic Games, do similar things. So Canada, for the 2010 Vancouver Winter Olympics, had a program called Own the Podium, where they put a lot of extra money into their programs. And the UK actually has a massive program in anticipation of London. They have invested hundreds of millions of dollars to try and bolster their performance in the games.
And where is the United States in all of this? Is the U.S. Also competitive when it comes to closely analyzing sports performance?
I mean, we have such a different model for most of these sports than other countries do. You know, in Australia and in the U.K., it's government funded. The Australian Olympic Committee and the Australian Institute of Sport receive a lot of money from the Australian government, and they allocate it. The U.S. Olympic Committee gets very, very little money from the government. It's almost exclusively funded through donations. And so what you have, actually, to take it back to Lolo Jones, is this whole project was done by one of her commercial sponsors. A project like this in Australia might have been done governmentally, and in the States it's done because, you know, she's got a particular relationship with a particular company.
You know, our listeners are probably familiar with books like Outliers that say, to become the best at something, you need 10,000 hours of focused effort. But I understand at the Australian Institute of Sport, they found ways that they can hack that process, you know, sort of cut off a few thousand hours, perhaps, and make you a better athlete. Tell me about how they do that.
They did something really fascinating. Skeleton is a sport that not a lot of people are familiar with. It's
That's where
like
you
bobs.
Hurl yourself headfirst. Down
head
a
first, yeah. It's
ice
a, you're
chute.
On a sled head first down the ice chute.
Tretyakov was the man with a lightning fast start, and again he was very quick. Lying in third place going into this run, and he would zip down the tube.
It looks really terrifying. The scientists at AIS were sort of curious, like, what would happen if we really focused our energy and attention on developing a skeleton athlete. What they didn't have in Australia were a skeleton track or any skeleton sliders at all. There weren't any.
Which you think would be a big problem.
Which you would think would be a big problem. They very cleverly sort of analyzed the sport and looked for what were the determinants of exceptional performances in a skeleton race. And it turns out that the best predictor of your performance had nothing to do with sort of the skill of driving the sled, although that was important. The biggest predictor was how fast you could push it. You push it at the start and jump on, and athletes who had the fastest push times tended to do the best in the races. You just had more velocity to start. And so they did a nationwide search for female athletes with explosive sprinting power. And they found a bunch of track athletes, and then they found a bunch of lifeguards. There are lifeguarding competitions in Australia where athletes sort of sprint back and forth on the sand. So they gathered this group of athletes and then tried to cram years of experience into their brains in 18 months. And they qualified an athlete for the Olympics 18 months after she had first seen a sled.
That's an amazing feat right there. But did they medal?
She did not medal. She had finished as high as sixth in the World Cup that year. But most of her competitors had been doing this for years and years. It really was a sort of stunning demonstration that certainly one way to get good at something is to spend 10,000 hours doing it. But there are other ways to be world class at something.
And how far do you think this trend can go? Do you think we've reached a point where there is no more room for improvement?
I don't think we have, no. I mean, what I think we've reached is a point where we increasingly find ourselves in not just a competition between two athletes at the starting line of a race, but we find ourselves in a competition between two athletes and their entire scientific support and training staffs. The athlete is sort of the tip of an increasingly large pyramid that enables their success.
Doesn't that take the fun out of it, or maybe the sport out of it? And does this mean that anybody who doesn't have this team of scientists and technicians has no hope of getting a medal or maybe even reaching the Olympics?
I think that it's not like a car race where engineers and mechanics build a car and the driver pilots the car. And to some large extent, it's a technological competition. It's still an athletic competition. There's still the role of the athlete on the starting line who has to perform under pressure, who has to deal with all of the myriad stresses before the event. That said, I do think that transcendent physical talent will get you still pretty far, but it will be harder and harder to rely solely upon that.
So you think it'll still be fun to watch because somebody who's highly trained and has been examined could, like Lolo Jones did in the 2008 Olympics, trip on a hurdle.
Yeah, I mean, there's still, you know, part of the unique role I think that sports plays, certainly for me as a sports fan, is the unexpected, is that, and not just the unexpected, but the sort of accidentally transcendent from time to time, that you'll see people do things that are awe-inspiring and beautiful and surprising, and that doesn't go away. I think that that continues to be enhanced over time. As we get better and better at sports, we'll see those performances get better. It just won't be at the same sort of rate that perhaps we've seen in the past.
Mark McCluskey of Wired Magazine. You can find a link to his Wired Magazine article, Building Better Olympic Athletes, at hereandnow.org. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Thank you.
Next week on Here and Now, author and public radio host Kurt Anderson says that the 1960s not only produced societal gains, but also left a legacy of selfishness. That's next week. News is next, Here and Now.